Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we continue our examination of criminal justice in the Bay Area, this time with a discussion of the federal crime bill. The First Step Act was signed by President Trump last December, and the first prisoner release as a consequence of this act occurred this past Friday. Championing the bill was the Oakland-based organization #Cut50, whose goal is to reduce the United States prison population by 50%. The United States incarcerates over 2.2 million people. We could cut our prison population in half and still have the highest incarceration rate in the world. #Cut50 is proud that this bill is an example of rare bipartisan agreement in a bitterly partisan political environment. The organization has successfully cultivated the support of President Trump, Jared Kushner, and even reality TV star Kim Kardashian in service of its criminal justice reform goals. Nevertheless, the federal crime bill has not gotten enthusiastic support from others working on criminal justice reform. Is this bill a big win for the movement or just a minor step, as some have suggested? What is #Cut50 hoping to achieve next with this momentum and high-profile status? And what would another act, the Next Step Act, look like? To discuss all this and more, I'm pleased to welcome to the studio Erin Haney. She is National Policy Director of #Cut50 and a former Deputy Public Defender in San Francisco. Welcome, Erin.
Welcome. Good evening.
And we're joined by phone by Tony Platt, Distinguished Affiliated Scholar at UC Berkeley's Center for the Study of Law and Society and author of Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on the program.
And in about 20 minutes, we'll invite you, our listeners, to dial in with your questions or comments for our guests. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can also send your questions and comments to our panel anytime by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw.org. So, Erin Haney, I want to start with you. Why don't you tell us about the First Step Act? What does it actually do?
Sure. So the First Step Act does a tremendous amount. While it is just a first step in terms of criminal justice reform, it actually works on conditions of confinement, sentencing reform, as well as preparing people for release. So while some of the provisions may seem minor to people whose lives aren't actually at stake, the act itself really does a tremendous amount to mitigate the horrors of our criminal justice system.
So why don't you go through those three points in a little bit more detail and tell us about provisions of the act.
Absolutely. So the first thing I'll talk about is what it does for conditions of confinement. So how it changes the lives of people who are actually having to survive behind bars. It makes a number of changes, including things like how far you are from your family. So the First Step Act includes a provision that requires that you be housed within 500 driving miles from your family. This may be something that seems small to people who aren't behind bars, but being able to have contact with your loved ones is incredibly important. It's important not just on a human level. It's also important in terms of reducing recidivism and encouraging positive behavior behind bars.
500 miles seems quite far. So less than 500 is already an improvement, it sounds like, from your point of view.
Absolutely. So as the federal system existed prior to the First Step Act, people could be shipped all over the United States, incredibly far from their family, unable to see their children, their parents, their siblings, completely disconnected from their communities. So although it is still a far difference or distance, it is still an incredible improvement. Another provision that was incredibly important in the First Step Act were the Dignity for Incarcerated Women provisions. In the federal system, women could still be shackled while pregnant, shackled while giving birth. They could be confined in solitary confinement during the postpartum period. They could be denied sanitary napkins, tampons. and be forced to suffer beyond just the basic level of suffering that occurs with incarceration. So the First Step Act was really an important piece of legislation to mitigate the horror specifically for women behind bars. Women have grown in terms of their incarceration over 600% in the last 25 years. And it's a population that we rarely talk about when we talk about criminal justice reform.
Okay. Were there other provisions that related to conditions of incarceration?
Absolutely. So there are a ton of provisions that relate to conditions. I'm just highlighting a few of them. You know, there are other important provisions that relate to phone calls, that relate to visitation. But those are some of the major ones that we felt really affected the core population of people behind bars.
Okay, so then early release or changes in sentencing.
Absolutely. So the First Step Act also included really important changes to sentencing laws in the federal system. The first really important change that it incorporated was making the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 retroactive. So in 2010, with the Fair Sentencing Act, the federal government changed the disparity between crack sentencing and cocaine sentencing. Unfortunately, it didn't make it 1-to-1, but it did change it from 100-to-1 to 18-to-1, which again, sort of like the 500 miles distance, it's hard to believe that it's an improvement, but it really truly is. Unfortunately, with the Fair Sentencing Act, they did not make it retroactive, which means even though the government recognized that this was a complete injustice, we still left a number of people behind bars under these disparate sentencing provisions. So when the First Step Act made it retroactive, we saw the release of currently, I believe there's been 1,600 people released under that provision alone, and over 90% of them were African Americans. So you can also see the incredible disparity that occurred as a result of that particular provision. Mm. It also contained a number of other important sentencing provisions, all of which had disparate impacts on people of color. So it changed 924C, which is a stacking provision having to do with gun charges. It also changed the safety valve for mandatory minimums. So people who were coming before federal courts to be sentenced, if they had a certain level of criminal history points, they would not be eligible for the judge to use his or her discretion to go below the mandatory minimum. And what they found when they looked at the data is that the vast majority of people who were ineligible were people of color. And the First Step Act broadened the safety valve to allow more discretion there.
Okay, so so these are people who would not have otherwise been released under the 2015 Fair Sentencing Act that allowed for this recalculation, right?
Yes.
How many people are potentially going to be able to be set free because of this?
So as I mentioned, there are 1,600 people who are already set free under the Fair Sentencing Act mm-hmm. retroactivity clause, so the crack and cocaine. In terms of the other sentencing provisions, those are not retroactive. There's another important one that I do want to mention just quickly, which changed mandatory sentencing for drug crimes. It was 851 and 841. So it changed a mandatory sentence for some third-time drug offenders from life down to 25 years, and a mandatory sentence for some second-time drug offenders from 20 down to 15 years. These provisions are not retroactive, so it's hard to say how many people it will affect, but okay. It is now going forward. The law has been changed as a result of the First Step Act.
So these are new things that were not included in the Fair Sentencing Act.
That's right.
Okay. Other changes, changes to what happens to people besides conditions, what services or supports they're given while they're incarcerated, right?
Absolutely. So there are a ton of changes that work to get people prepared to get out. And one of the changes that is sort of, I would say, partly related to sentencing because it affects the amount of time that people are inside, but also really related to recidivism and preparing to leave, are the good time recalculation credits. So up until the First Step Act, people were allowed 47 days of good time recalculation. So if they had good behavior in prison, which is easier said than done, because you can get a violation for having an extra pair of socks, for stepping outside of the lines on the yard, for any number of reasons, you can be written up and have your good time credits taken away. But assuming you are somehow able to navigate all of these horrendous rules inside of prison, you can get your good time calculation and have time earned essentially off of your sentence. Up until the First Step Act, it was being calculated as 47 days per year. After the First Step Act, it's calculated as 54 days per year. And so the mass release that we saw just on Friday, where it was around 3,000 people that were released, were a result of the good time recalculations. In addition to sort of fixing simple faulty math that the corrections department was employing to keep people in for longer, the First Step Act also has a number of provisions that seek to get people job ready, ready to get back into their communities, more connected to employers on the outside. And that has a lot to do with the earned time credit system. So under the First Step Act, people will be assessed under a risk and needs assessment system. Currently in prisons, people are frequently assessed for their risk. So a Department of Corrections will look at somebody's likelihood of having poor behavior in prison, their likelihood of reoffending. It's based almost entirely on static factors and is incredibly subjective. So the First Step Act changed that to say we need to not only look at risk, but we really need to look at needs and at strengths, and examine what people need in order to be able not just to survive when they get out of prison, but to thrive. And so that system matches people with services inside of prison. It ensures that there are certain programs available in prisons where people need them the most. And then it also helps them go through a number of logistics that can be incredibly trying before your release. So even simple things like getting your identification, signing up for benefits, all of that, it requires that those things begin before release, as opposed to releasing people out into the community, telling them good luck, often saying, we'll see you back in 6 months. And so this instead really seeks to get people prepared.
So, and then when people are released, are they released on parole, or are they transitioned to probation in a state system? What happens?
Sure. So it varies depending on the sentence, the crime, the area, all of that. There's, you know, every case is somewhat different. With earned time credits, for example, so if you've been doing well in programming and you've earned a certain amount off of your sentence, you go into what's called pre-release custody. So you don't get just released out into the community. You often go to a halfway house. There's some conversations about electronic monitoring. There's a variety of different procedures that somebody may go through once they are released. So it varies depending on the person's circumstance. But for the most part, people do continue to be under supervision. And our hope is that we are preparing people and giving them enough tools to successfully navigate supervision, which is also in and of itself an incredibly oppressive and difficult system to navigate.
Right. So thanks for that overview of the First Step Act. It seems to have a lot of provisions that, as you said, deal with the conditions of people in federal prisons. And we're being clear here, this is about federal prisons and not state prisons, where most of the people in the United States are incarcerated. And then we talked about issues that were specifically about the disparities in sentencing that are racially motivated when you look at the especially the crack to cocaine sentencing ratio. And then a lot of focus on what happens to people or preparing for people people for when they leave. So I wanted to turn next to Tony Platt from UC Berkeley's Center for the Study of Law and Society to get your take on the First Step Act. It sounds like it hits a lot of points here. What's your appraisal?
Well, as somebody who's not just an academic, but has been a long-time activist for serious prison reform and worked on issues around prisons and incarceration since the 1970s, and as somebody who supports reforms and reducing people's time and getting people out of prison before their term is up, I have a very close relative who just got out of doing time in California and had his time reduced, and I know people who have been lifers in California who got out instead of spending the rest of their days in prison. So I'm supportive of all of that, and I wish I could be more supportive of the First Step Act, which I don't really see as the First Step Act. It's really sort of standing in place more than taking a first step, and I don't see it at this point leading to anything more substantial in changing, creating reforms that will bring justice and humanity to millions of people.
So say more about why you feel this isn't really a step forward, but in fact, as you say, standing in place.
Well, you know, I respect the work that Eric Haney and the Cut 50 has been doing and other reformers have been doing, but just look at the title of that organization. This is a movement that began, you know, 15, 20 years ago, where people started talking about what it would take to reduce the nationwide prison population by 50%. Other people, like myself, wanted to see 70 or 80 or even 90% of the prison population reduced. And to go from that to accepting less than 1% and only federal prisoners starts off for me by being a retreat. You know, it's a sadness to have to accept that as a substantial reform. More specifically, I think there are a number of stings in the tail of this First Step Act that we need to look at more carefully. First of all, it doesn't exactly set people free who have been let out of the first 2,000 or 3,000 that have been reduced from federal prisons under the First Step Act. One-third of them go into other prisons or into other forms of incarceration or into deportation. People are going to get tracked out of the country or into another kind of prison in fairly sizable numbers. I think we'll wait to see if that's true. It looks like about one-third at the moment. Secondly, I think the First Step asks us to make a kind of Sophie's choice, you know, between who are the deserving folks who should get out and who are the people that should stay in. So anybody that went to prison, federal prison, for doing anything that in any way was related to violence, you know, for example, an armed robbery or a burglary involving violence or assault, is exempt from the First Step Act and can't appreciate its reforms and its possibilities. Also, people, the many thousands of people who are in for immigration-related activities and potential deportation or crimes are not eligible. And I think having to make a choice between sort of selective prisoners who are considered to be the worthy ones basically means that we're being asked to turn our back on the majority of people who are in the prisons. So that's one set of issues. A second set of issues is that built into the act is the privileging of religious programs. There's a lot of emphasis on encouraging more and more religious programs to come in and work with people inside the prison and also to work with people outside the prison. This has been underway nationwide now for a long time with very little success. I don't have any problems with prisoners having a right to religious practices of their choices inside the prison or to religious organizations volunteering to help people on the outside. But I do think it's a problem when a federal piece of legislation basically says that religious organizations are going to be better at doing something than secular organizations or state organizations. And I'd like to see the state welfare systems and public services come back into prison and after prison programs in a large way. And then a third example would be that sort of buried in this act too is the notion that people will be let out of prison and then with the development of electronic shackling and monitoring of people in their homes and the communities, that this will be an improvement on prison life. Now, it probably will. I mean, I'd rather be at home and electronically shackled than be in a prison. But this suggests a shift that's taking place where more and more electronic monitoring and shackling is going to be in place. And this is going to be, instead of reducing the prison population, it's going to shift many people in the incarcerated population into the homes and their communities. And this is also going to be another boondoggle for the prison industrial and police industrial complex that is going to be manufacturing, is already manufacturing these kinds of electronic monitoring systems that are going to now make money off it. So for all those reasons, I'm very disappointed in this First Step Act, and I think that we've settled for too little.
All right. So, Tony Platt, thanks for your comments there. I'm going to, of course, let Aaron Haney respond. But just to summarize again what you said, that that not only was the initial aim to cut the prison population by 50% did not go far enough, but the fact that it's limited, the First Step Act is limited to federal prisoners, which are a much smaller percentage of the prison population in total across the United States, sort of limited its impact to begin with. And then there's a couple, several in issues in your mind that it does not necessarily set people free in the way that you think people should be set free. And in fact, there's issues of leaving out prisoners of violent crime, prisoners that have committed violent crimes from being able to take benefit from prison sentencing and other conditions, reforms from other conditions. So I'm going to now let you, Aaron, go through these one by one. So take it away.
Sure. So I appreciate and understand all of those comments, and I think that they are, you know, at their core, fair critiques, and in fact, critiques that I share. I would also like to see the prison population cut by 70 or 80%. Cut 50 was an organization that formed with the initial goal of having it cut by 50%, and of course, hopeful that we could move beyond that. We are a group of people who work not only in the federal system, but in almost every single state in the United States. So we also work very, very hard on state reforms as well. And those are both on conditions of confinement reforms as well as sentencing reforms. And so we are working very, very hard to do what we can to improve not only the criminal justice system, but also the lives of people who are behind bars. I also want to point out that Cut 50 is really run by and led by people who are directly impacted by the criminal justice system. So we have a number of people who work in every state as part of the empathy network who have themselves been formerly incarcerated or who have loved ones who are incarcerated currently, who work very, very hard to not only envision what the reforms would be like, but to get to the table and really make sure that their voices are echoed in the text of the laws and that the reforms are then, in fact, implemented. So in terms of the First Step Act not going far enough, I think most of us would agree with that. I don't think that it means that the First Step Act is not a victory. I think that when you talk to the people who are coming home as a result of the First Step Act, when you talk to the people who are no longer behind bars, when you talk to the women who are no longer terrified of being shackled while pregnant in federal prison, it's really hard to look at that and say that that's meaningless. Is it the end of the reforms? Absolutely not. Do any of us feel like we are satisfied with how far the First Step Act went? Absolutely not. But I also think, especially having been a public defender and specifically an attorney for people on death row in California for the last decade or so, that it is important to also share in some of these victories when people do come home. When we were working on the First Step Act, we were working with a Republican Congress, and we were working under a president who came in talking about law and order and fire and fury. And I think a number of us thought that this could be the end of some of the progress that we had made in prior attempts to pass a similar bill. And so we really had to work within the constraints that we were given with folks like Senator Tom Cotton and Jeff Sessions, who are very vocal against even some of these minor reforms. So I think when you actually look at the people that are coming home and you look at the hope that this has given some people, as well as the practical changes it has made in terms of of conditions in confinement and just the way that it has changed the narrative, frankly. So I agree that there is a ton more to be done, but I also think that it's incredibly important to recognize that we are at least now in a place where we are on both sides of the aisle recognizing that mass incarceration is incredibly damaging, both to the people behind bars, but also to the communities of people who are outside of those bars.
I want to make sure you get to answer to the other points here as well, that, you know, when people are released from federal confinement, they're not necessarily set free. They're either sent to other prisons. Perhaps they are deported. And then there are those who otherwise wouldn't have been subject to electronic monitoring who will be. And that is sort of perhaps not complete. The idea of setting people free is not a completely accurate picture when you think about those things.
Sure. So again, I think it depends on who we are talking about. The First Step Act did not make any changes to the immigration system, which I agree is incredibly unfortunate. It was a point of contention in the argument in terms of passing it, and clearly folks at Cut 50 and most of the organizations that we worked with on the left wanted to see it make changes to the immigration system. That was not possible. So it is true that there are people who would be released from federal prison, but who have an immigration hold or a state prison hold. And so those people won't actually be released. That's not something that the First Step Act changed. That's something that existed before the First Step Act as well. So those aren't changes that we were able to make. They just remain the same. In terms of coming out and not being completely free, most of the people that we work with who have themselves been in prison. And so I want to mention, for example, Topeka Sam, who is our Dignity for Incarcerated Women director, will tell you that when you are released from prison, you are not free. For the most part, you are under incredibly restrictive probation or parole rules, and that those can be really, really difficult to navigate. Again, that is not something that First Step Act changed. There are a number of people who were released who did not go into halfway homes, who did not have electronic monitoring, but who were under parole. Parole and probation is something that Cut 50 cares a lot about and also works to reform as well. So while those systems may not have been reformed by the First Step Act, it's certainly something that as an organization we continue to fight. I think it is undeniable, though, that the trauma and oppression and abuses that occur behind prison walls are lasting and severe, and that while there is undeniable trauma as a result of being under community supervision as well, it is different. And so part of the goal here was to mitigate the harmful effects of the criminal justice system.
Just want to get through a couple more points briefly so that we can get Tony to respond and also get some callers on the air. The issue of focusing on nonviolent offenders, that's the first one. And the second is privileging of religious programs, as Tony puts it.
Sure. So for the first one, in terms of focusing on nonviolent offenders, one of the biggest debates around First Step Act was who would be included in earned time credit. So again, this is the credit that you would get for participating in productive recidivism reducing programming. And Cut 50, along with an entire coalition of organizations, was pushing as hard as possible to get as many people included in that as we could. And again, given the landscape, there were exclusions that were made based on that. And that was a compromise. And again, as somebody who spent most of my career representing people on death row, it's incredibly important to me that people behind bars who are there who are convicted of violent offenses are actually the people who get the most services, not the least. And so one of the things that the First Step Act does do, although there are exclusions for some quote-unquote violent offenders, is that it does make sure that services within the prison and conditions of confinement changes within the prison are available to everybody. And again, I think on the outside, it's much easier to say, well, that's not good enough. But I think when you're the one actually suffering behind bars, it is still a step forward, a first step forward. As for the religious programming, again, there were several programs that are considered to be recidivism reducing and productive programming under the First Step Act. So while there are some sort of spelled out provisions that relate to faith-based provisions, by no means are those the only provisions that the First Step Act includes or focuses on.
Okay. Let me reintroduce the program, and then, Tony, I'm going to let you to respond. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight, as part of our series on criminal justice in the Bay Area, we're talking about the federal crime bill with Aaron Haney, National Policy Director of Hashtag Cut50, and a former Deputy Public Defender in San Francisco, and Tony Platt, Distinguished Affiliated Scholar at UC Berkeley's Center for the Study of Law and Society and author of Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. We invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation with your questions and comments. What do you think about the approaches to criminal justice reform? Should they be incremental? Should they be taking larger steps? Join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255, or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or on our Facebook page. And we're also on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So Tony Platt, what I'm hearing from Aaron Haney is that this is not the end. This is just a start. It sounds like a lot of strategic thinking went into this, given the political environment, and that this bipartisan approach shouldn't be overlooked.
Well, let me just provide a little bit of history, because I think it tells us something about what I see as the problems with the First Step Act. About 10 or 11 years ago, leaders inside the Republican Party decided that they needed to do something about criminal justice reform. And this was at a time when, within the Republican Party, there were debates going on about the fact that the Republican hard line on crime and justice and police had basically driven out potential African American and Latino voters and progressive voters from supporting Republicans. So they convened a meeting, and Newt Gingrich was there, and Rand Paul was there, and people from the libertarian conservative wings of the Republican Party was there. And they invited people in who were also from nonprofit organizations to be a part of that discussion. So that was then. And at that time, people from liberal and progressive organizations sort of dominated the narrative and had a much more radical vision of what they hoped would happen with prison reform and reduce the amount of incarceration in the country. Then increasingly, the right and libertarian wings of the Republican Party began to control that debate and control that political agenda. And I don't have any problems with bipartisan politics. I don't have any problems with coalitions where you try to negotiate and come to agreements with people who are on different sides of a political issue. But in this situation, the libertarian and conservative wing of the Republican Party and the White House have dominated this debate and been able to gut prison reform of anything that we would consider to be the kind of thing that a progressive grassroots activist organization like Cut50 would be into. All the negotiations that have gone on and all the concessions that have gone on have really given tremendous ground to the right in this debate and allowed the White House and the Republican right to have a victory, a political victory on this issue, where they threw a party in the White House to celebrate prison reform. And this is taking place at a time when the Republican Party in particular and the White House are pushing for more detention and deportations of immigrants, of expanding the network of prisons and incarceration for immigrants and people, undocumented people. It's come at a time when the White House has withdrawn from all the reform initiatives to do something about the cops who go in extraordinary militarized ways into poor communities and communities of color. So the police reform that was very much on the agenda during the Obama years is gone. And so that we're left with this tiny little piece of reform. And I think for grassroots organizations to support this and say that this is what reform is and where it's going, I think, creates an illusion of a new narrative and not really a new narrative at all.
So, Tony, are you saying that when you first opened with your comments, you said this was not a step forward, it was standing in place. I got a feeling that you were suggesting that this is actually perhaps a step backward.
Well, it could be a step backward. If you look at the long history of so-called criminal justice reforms, you know, the juvenile justice system, the indeterminate sentencing, different programs for public health programs to that ended up sterilizing women in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. There's been a long history of criminal justice reform that have actually ended up expanding the net of social control and legitimating carceral institutions. And my worry here is that after everything is settled from the First Step Act, we'll be left with a carceral system that's going to expand into different kinds of electronic shackling, that's going to basically write off millions of people because they got arrested in their 20s for an act involving violence, and that we basically support a right-wing political agenda of reform. And I think that kind of coalition and that kind of concession means giving up too much.
So back to you, Aaron, that the concern here that Tony has that somehow the strategy that you took to bring bipartisan support has led to controlling of the narrative and perhaps how far this can go under the current Republican administration and climate in Washington has somehow led to a series of consequences that will set things back.
So again, I've spent the last 10 years working with people in prison, and when we waged this fight for the First Step Act, we did so alongside of and often behind people who themselves had been formerly incarcerated. And I think talking to any of the many advocates who lived this life and who were forced to be behind bars in the federal system, and talking to any of the people who have been released under the First Step Act, I think it's very, very clear that this is a first step in the right direction. I share many of the concerns raised around the carceral state, around electronic monitoring. It's not that I don't think that those are important concerns. I absolutely do. But I think that the First Step Act does what it can to mitigate the reality that we are living in now for people who are actually suffering behind bars. And I think it did a whole lot to move the conversation in the direction of us understanding that punishment and justice are not always one and the same, that they are in fact two different things, and that people behind bars are human beings. They are often incredibly talented, and that they deserve dignity, humane treatment, and that they deserve love and support when they come home.
So one more time to put the number out for listeners to join our conversation here on City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. We're talking about the federal crime bill and what people who helped pass it say is a big step in criminal justice reform. And we have a voice from UC Berkeley saying that it didn't go far enough and perhaps may set things back. That's Aaron Haney, from director of hashtag Cut50, who's the part of the organization that sponsored the bill, and also that is an Oakland-based organization, and Tony Platt from UC Berkeley's Center for Study of Law and Society. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw. So, Tony, given the political realities in Washington, how could you have envisioned something that made more substantive reforms in your mind? And it sounds like there's no disagreement between the two of you necessarily about kind of where things need to go. It's just about how to get there and how fast to get there and the strategy. What strategy would you have taken?
Well, from looking at the history of efforts to try to make significant changes in prisons and policing and so on that I do in my book, I come to the conclusion that the only way to make any kind of substantial changes is to organize people from below and to have very strong activist mass movements that put pressure on the political system. I mean, for a while there was a a part of the Democratic Party before the Clinton administration that would support community activists and supported all kinds of progressive reforms. But pretty much with the election of Clinton, bipartisan politics of criminal justice basically became different versions of law and order. I mean, Clinton famously went back to Arkansas to defend capital punishment of a man who was mentally disabled. Clinton put out strong law and order arguments and said that the Democratic Party had to take law and order positions in order to compete with the Republican Party and get back the White House. It was Clinton that took about 2 or 3 million families off welfare and created a welfare system that criminalized poor women and children and so on. So if you, from that history, really from the Johnson days on, but particularly from the Clinton administration on, it's been very difficult at the top to see much that's difference between the two political parties in terms of law and order, in terms of policing, in terms of crime control, in terms of the whole politics of law and order. And if you look at the times when there have been some successes, for example, in the 70s, when there was a moratorium on capital punishment for a short period of time, when Massachusetts and some other places abolished juvenile institutions, when many state prisons opened the doors to all kinds of educational programs, but that came as a result of the civil rights and women's and black liberation and social movements that pushed for those kinds of changes. I don't think serious kinds of change on these issues is going to be possible without those kinds of movements putting pressure. And secondly, I think that we have to be a multi-issue movement. I think just looking at prison reform is not going to make any substantial changes, because really the problems with the criminal justice system start with the cops on the beat who are arresting people for mostly petty things and getting them into jail and juvenile institutions at a very early age, reducing their chances of a decent job or education and putting them on the path later on to state and prisons and city jails and so on. So without fundamental changes in policing, I don't think we're going to see any other changes down the road in criminal justice. And also without significant coalitions between immigrant organizations and criminal justice organizations, I think we're going to have these divisions between organizations that support prison reform and organizations that support immigration reform. I think in both cases we've been very weak and been very ineffective, and it's going to take not only movements but coalitions between people engaged in different kinds of struggles to be successful.
So, Aaron, what do you make of Tony's comments?
So I agree that it's incredibly important to have a coalition that's built from the ground up, and that it's important to have activists, especially activists who are directly impacted by the issues that we are seeking to change, take the lead. I think it's also important, absolutely, to recognize the horrific systems of injustice that are at work when we talk about the criminal justice system, how it is also about policing, not just about incarceration in a vacuum. And I think that the First Step Act, again, did what it could to mitigate the horrific realities that people face behind bars. And I think that is it wide sweeping change? I think no, it's a first step, but it's incredibly important for the people who are actually living that reality. And I think that telling the hundreds of people who have now been released under the compassionate release and elderly provisions, for example, and telling the thousands of people who have been released under, you know, the changes from First Step, that really they should have simply waited and stayed behind bars until we could make more change happen, is unfair. And so I think that it's important and, in fact, essential to continue fighting for more and more change. Again, this is the first step. It is by no means the end. And so I think I agree in terms of the importance of incorporating activists, additional movements. And I do just want to point out also that Cut 50 was founded by Van Jones and also by Jessica Jackson, who founded the organization because her husband went to prison and she found herself with a newborn baby having to figure out what to do and what it would mean for his life. And so this was really you know, a movement or an organization founded by people who had some lived experience with it as well.
And I might add, your brother, Supervisor Matt Haney, was one of the co-founders of the Cut 50 movement as well. So Tony, what of that point of like you got to get what you can, and you can't, and that's a good thing too.
Yes, of course. And there's organizations all over the country working to try to alleviate the misery that people live under in this country right now. There are people in California that are active to get people out of jail and out of prison, and that's going on. And I wasn't suggesting that we should sort of give up on any kind of short-term immediate reform while we fight for something bigger down the road. I think reforms are very important. I think we've also got to critically look at reform and what does it mean to get some people out. We're talking about, again, less than 1% of people who, if this act is implemented as it's supposed to be, less than 1% of incarcerated people will get early release, and some of them will end up in different kinds of institutions. But to do that and to leave the prison door and to look around and know that they're leaving 2.1 million people still behind doors, that they're being abandoned and are being basically written off. That's a very heavy thing for people to carry that burden of knowing that they're getting out and other people are staying in, people who did things when they were young. And I mean, one out of three people in California right now in prison are there for life. I mean, we're talking about people who are aging and dying in prisons all over the country. So anything we can do to make life inside prison more like life outside, and anything we can do to reduce prison sentences and get people out, I totally support. But to put a whole lot of political energy into a reform, which I think is largely illusory, and to make coalitions with people on their terms who don't have the best interests of people in mind, that really worries me about a program that calls itself reform.
All right. So, Aaron, I'm going to have you make a last comment in this, and then I want to build on the overlap between the both of you, which is the fact that you actually both think that that there needs to be more done at more levels, state level and as well. So just a brief response to that.
Sure. So very briefly, the numbers for the First Step Act suggest that it will reduce the federal prison population by about 30% over the next 10 years. So again, it is not wide sweeping. It isn't cutting it by 80 or 90% as we would like, but I do also want to push back against the notion that it is less than 1% of the federal prison population that this will affect. I also, again, want to point out that this is very much not just about letting people out, but about how we treat people when they are in. It's about recognizing the humanity and dignity of people behind bars and about doing what we can every single day and every single moment for people who are stuck in that horror. And First Step Act, while it is, again, just a first step, and while there's much, much more to do, the reality of those changes for people behind bars in the federal system and those people who got to come home is everything, and it's huge.
So let's turn
next. Can I just correct one thing?
Yeah, go ahead, sure.
So I either misspoke or wasn't heard right, but the First Step Act will benefit at its best about 8,000 to 10,000 people out of 2.2 million plus people that are in institutions all over the country, jails and state prisons and federal prisons. So by my math, we're talking about less than 1% of the overall incarcerated population will benefit from this reform.
Okay, I think we've clarified that. So I just do want to make sure we use the energy that is on both sides of this conversation tonight to talk about where do we go next, especially since, as I think everyone understands, that the federal prison population is a small percentage of the larger incarcerated population in the United States. How do we take these concerns to the state level? I'll start with you, Tony Platt.
At the state level, I think it's the same at the federal level, except in the states you can at least organize effectively at a community level and have an impact on state politics. In California right now, with a Democrat-controlled legislature and a governor that seems open to reforms, there's lots of possibilities. So I think we should be fighting to do massive reduction of the prison population. The state of California is under court order to reduce its prison population. It still has a ways to go. We still have many institutions that are overcrowded in violation of the Supreme Court decisions. So we should be doing a massive reduction of prison population. And I would like to see, again, the notion of 50, 60, 70, 80% of prison populations being reduced in places like California. I think we need to spend a lot more energy talking about what goes on with policing, which is really where the problem begins, and talk about what it would mean to have something we've never had, which is a non-militarized police force, a police force that is trained to serve communities. And also, I think we should continue the debate that's happening in many cities now about what do we need the police for, what can be done by other community agencies and community organizations and public services that the police currently do, but what work do we need them for, and what don't we need them for? They've become sort of the substitute welfare system in many parts of the country. I think we need to open up that conversation. And finally, I would say we need to really seriously take on the issue of bail, because it's cash bail since the 1960s, as we know from all the studies, has resulted in the majority of people in local and city and county jails being there before they've even been tried or convicted, because they don't have the money to get out. I think if we did away with cash bail and use community and family members to vouch for people while they're waiting trial or disposition of cases, that would do a great deal to massively reduce the jail population by maybe 50-60%.
And what I was going to ask you is, how do you address the issue of the scope of who's included in reforms? How do you bring the conversation to issues around looking at violent offenders when that might not be as easy a sell, perhaps?
No, it won't. It's a difficult one, given that law and order campaigns have demonized people for doing things that they did in their youth. I mean, we have a criminal justice system that exempts people that engage in massive amounts of violence. If you think, for example, about the tobacco companies that knowingly distributed tobacco and knowing that it would reduce the lives of millions of people when they had that information. Or if you look at the pharmaceutical companies that continued to promote opioids, knowing that they were dangerously addictive and that led to tens or hundreds of thousands of people dying from overdoses. I mean, that's the politics of violence as well, except we don't think of that as violence. We think of that as business as usual. So part of changing the narrative is to get us to understand that violence is widespread in the United States, and that systemic violence is not something that just individuals do, but that corporations and organizations engage in.
So, Aaron, what is Cut 50 doing now at the state level? You mentioned that you're working on other aspects besides the federal prison reform.
Yeah, so I think we're invested in quite a bit about what was just being talked about, that we agree that really reforming the systems are important. And I want to start with where he ended, which is talking about the narrative. Tucker Carlson was on tonight calling everybody who was released under the First Step Act rapists and murderers. And so really a great deal of what Cut 50 aims to do, again, through our empathy network and through people who are directly impacted, is to change the narrative around what people in prison look like, what it means to be in prison, the obstacles people face when they come out, and to really increase empathy and dignity. And so to that end, we do a lot around changing the conversation. We also do a lot around trying to get people to think about alternatives to incarceration in the first place. So we are sponsoring a bill here in California, Senate Bill 394, which is authored by Senator Nancy Skinner, which is a pretrial diversion bill for primary caregivers. And so the act seeks to recognize the fact that when you send a caregiver to prison, you are not just punishing the person who is in prison, you are also punishing their children and the family and really the community at large. And so what this bill would do, and it's one of many examples of the bills that Cut 50 works on, but what this bill would do is it it would give the judge the option to instead send the primary caregiver to a diversion program where they could get the support that they need, where they would not be incarcerated, and where, in fact, if they do well in the diversion program, they would not be saddled with a conviction.
And would Cut 50 also want to broaden the pool of eligible people in confinement to include violent offenders?
Absolutely. So again, Cut 50 is very interested in helping as many people as we can, and as I said, mitigating the effects of this incredibly harmful criminal justice system. We think that people who have been convicted of violent crimes are also people who have experienced a tremendous amount of trauma. They are often the people who could most benefit from services and support, both while they're incarcerated and when they are released.
And also sentencing reform for those people.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So, you know, our view is that prison benefits very few, if any, people, and that to the extent that we are looking to help reduce crime and increase safety, there are a number of ways to do that that do not involve lengthy and oppressive physical incarceration.
And how about issues around policing, sort of getting at the front end here or upstream, as it were?
Sure. So Cut 50, again, is supportive of a number of the reforms around policing. As I mentioned, I was a public defender, and a lot of the cases that we saw, even in my limited time in that office, really had to do less with crime and oftentimes more with targeted and discriminatory and abusive, sometimes even deadly policing. So I think that we're very much in line with those reforms, and that we think that's also part of building empathy. There is an incredible empathy divide in this country. We see it in our politics, and we certainly see it in our justice system, and we see it on the streets and policing.
So, Tony Platt, you get the last word. Where do we go next from here? How do we harness all of the energy around this topic to get things to move towards a common goal?
Well, I'm really encouraged by what Aaron was just talking about. I think changing the narrative is a way in which we can do different kinds of work and maybe work together. I mean, changing the narrative is a huge, massive job. It means changing decades of thinking about people who are in institutions, prisons, and jails as sort of being a different kind of human being, as opposed to there but for the grace of God go I. I was very encouraged when I was going back and reading and studying about the history of the prison and criminal justice reform movements during the civil rights era, because the civil rights movement wouldn't have been possible without the humanity of the people who are inside institutions struggling for civil rights as well. And the prison really became an outpost of the civil rights struggle, and people thought of people inside and people outside as being part of a common humanity. So I think that's the political cultural struggle. It's just a very difficult one, and it's also not going to just take critiques of the political system, but it's also going to take tremendous challenges for our social and grassroots and activist movements to find ways of working together, building coalitions, and talking about our own common humanity.
Well, we'll leave it on that note. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Aaron Haney, National Policy Director of Hashtag Cut 50, Oakland-based organization, and a former Deputy Public Defender in San Francisco, and Tony Platt, Distinguished Affiliated Scholar at UC Berkeley's Center for the Study of Law and Society, and author of Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. Thanks to both of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Bye. Thanks.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next week when we tackle the rising cost of childcare in San Francisco. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week. His